This is the Working Drummer Podcast, featuring conversations with ground-level pros from all styles and regions. Real drummers with real stories about making a living in music.
Hey everyone, welcome to Working Drummer Podcast. I'm Zach Albetta, and this week I'm talking with Jordan Pearlson. Jordan grew up in the Philly area, spent 12 years on the New York scene where he played with fantastic artists across many genres, from Kenny Warner to Becca Stevens to Modest Yahoo, and then relocated to Nashville in 2016. His incorporation into the Nashville scene has been gradual, at first because he was still touring quite a bit with New York-based artists, then because of the pandemic. But recently he's been hitting his stride and finding his place there, collaborating with fellow recent Nashville transplants Jeff Coffin and Kirk Fletcher, and recording and teaching in his home studio. We would appreciate your support on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/workingdrummer, and a donation in any amount gets you access to exclusive content from our former guests. Think of this as professional development for drummers, all useful and actionable lessons for the working pro. We're populating new content regularly, and as little as $1 a month gets you access to all of it. If Patreon isn't your thing, you can also make a one-time donation through PayPal. There are links for both on our homepage at workingdrummer.net. While you're there, you can learn more about this episode and check out our archive of over 300 episodes. Also, please subscribe to Working Drummer Podcast on your platform of choice. We're available on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and YouTube, and be sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Lastly, however you listen, please leave us a rating and review. This helps new listeners find us. Our latest Patreon content features me. There's a new video there of me outlining a great warm-up routine I've been doing for close to 10 years now. There's so much out there that is billed as a warm-up when it's in fact more of a workout or a chop builder or something you should do after you actually warm up. So what's in that video is designed to just wake up your hands and arms if they're totally cold and get them ready for the higher demands of actual drumming. Also, great stuff on there from Ash Sohn, Don Perry, Joe Bergamini, Steven Chopek, and Chuck Palmer, talking about specific songs they've tracked drums for and all the technical and creative aspects of those recording processes. You can get access to this and the rest of our Patreon content for as little as $1 a month, so check that out. We'd really appreciate your support. Again, that's patreon.com/workingdrummer.
Now it's my turn, so you're bitter. And all you wanna do is blame me every time you lose.
So, as you'll hear, I've been an admirer of Jordan's for quite a while, but I wasn't aware that he'd moved to Nashville until recently. I wanted to talk to him because I think he's a great example of how the Nashville scene has been attracting and utilizing a different kind of drummer over the last few years. So here we go. Hope you dig. Jordan Pearlson. Been on my radar for longer than you might think, because from 2003 to 2010, I lived in Kansas City, and during my time there, I got to play a few times with Ben Markley. Do you remember him?
Fucking love Ben Markley. Oh, cursed already. Sorry. I love Ben Markley.
Yeah.
That guy, man.
Me too. Yeah, he was, you know, just like sending me the tracks that you guys had recorded to help me learn those tunes. And I was like, who the fuck is this guy? He was
thanks.
Jordan Pearlson in New York. So yeah, it's been like since then that I've kind of followed you a bit here and there. And you know, I didn't know that you were in Nashville until recently, when you popped up on it was that Kirk Fletcher gig with Ty Bailey, who's a great friend of mine.
Oh, cool! Yeah, that was just last week.
Yeah, yeah. So I saw that. I was like, "What, Pearlson's in Nashville? When did that happen? Why?"
it's been almost 6 years. Coming up on my 6 year anniversary of being in Nashville. But, you know, what I always kind of say to myself anyway is like I spent the first 3 years on the road with mostly like lots of New York folks that I was still and am still involved with. And then the next 2 years in was COVID.
Right.
And then this last, 9 months has been like the murky, weird, like, are we out of COVID? Or are we not out of COVID? So like, I, even though it's like been a calendar almost 6 years, it really hasn't felt like I've been here that long.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? Wow. So like there's a lot to unpack there. Why did you move to Nashville in the first place? Like if you were still touring with kind of these New York based artists who we'll talk about, why the move to Nashville?
New York's a tough place to live, you know,
like I've heard
whether you're like one of my really good friends there is she was a book editor. And now she's she works for a giant podcast company and like production company. But like, I used to like envy her because like she would just get on the train every morning and read a book or listen to a podcast or listen to music and like bring her purse, you know? And I was like, so you just get on the train without 50 pounds of cymbals and a snare drum and like a maybe an SPDS pad and like whatever else crazy stuff we need to like bring with us. And that's like, and you go to one place and you stay there for 8 hours and then maybe you stop for dinner or maybe you just come home and that's like your day, as opposed to like, I leave the house at 8 a.m. for my first thing. And then it's not worth it to me to come all the way home for my second. So I go and kill time till my second thing, all the while like hauling around all my crap. And, you know, so like a very typical day would be like, you know, whatever, 8 a.m. till 1 in the morning, you know, hauling all that stuff around, and you just never go home.
Right.
And, you know, from like when you're like 24, that's amazing. Like if you can have like 25 days in a row like that, it's success. Like that's a measure of success.
Yeah.
You know, as like a 20 something drummer in New York, like, you know what, you're not really worried about how much you're getting paid to do it. You're just like, I'm busy.
Yep.
This is successful. This is what success looks like.
Yep.
And then, you know, you grow up a little bit, you have back surgery, you have other things, you know, you have like a partner or a spouse to consider, and you're like, okay, things are a little different now. I can't, you know, expenses versus income are more important now. And my health is really important to me. And not that stuff wasn't important. It just becomes heightened as you get older.
Right.
And gigs weren't, you know, paying any better as time went on. So my wife at the time and I were talking about, you know, like kind of what's next. And I kind of always knew, as much as I loved New York and I made a lot of amazing music there and a ton of amazing friends. And they're still like very much family to me. I was like, I'm not going to be here forever.
Yeah.
Like I grew up in the suburbs, and I think like that's like some version of that will probably be, you know, well, you know, I was like, barring any tragedies, I'm not going to die here.
Right.
You know, it was kind of what I always knew.
Yeah.
And so we started talking about leaving, and I was like, okay, I've got, you know, two options. Either I can move to another music city, which is, you know, obviously just like Atlanta, Nashville, New York, or LA and Austin. And LA is a lateral move. So we took that right. A lateral move economically. So we took that off the table.
Right. And a lateral move in terms of just pain in the ass.
Yeah. It's a different kind of pain in the ass,
yeah.
but totally. And then I was like, oh, so those are our options. If I want to do another music city, or we can also move to somewhere that's just inexpensive and awesome to live, like Durham, North Carolina,
my dad lives there. I love that place.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. Durham's just like this, like all, like every time I'd stop there on the road or see friends or something, I was like, man, there's something very special about this little pocket of the country.
Yep.
I decided, at least for myself, I was like, I think I'm just barely young enough. I was in my mid 30s at the time. I was like, I still have the energy and the desire to like start over in a music city. If I waited another few years, I don't know if I'd have it in me. And I just moved to the Durham or whatever it is and hope that all my touring continued. And so we moved here. And like I said, I was on the road a lot with New York folks. And then I started playing with Adrian Ballou, who is based in Nashville, but not a Nashville person. He's right. just like lived here for 30 years, but like doesn't really involve himself in the scene here. So that wasn't much of a, you know, connector gig to like other Nashville based stuff. So I kind of don't really consider that a Nashville based gig.
Right.
And then I was very, very busy with Adrian and Beck Steven and Charlie Hunter and people like that right up until literally minutes before the pandemic, and then nothing like everybody else.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's just now that I'd imagine you're kind of going about the business of matriculating into the Nashville scene.
Yeah. I mean, I was doing it lightly in here and there. Like, I made a couple really key connections kind of early on, which were really great, that didn't necessarily lead to lots of stuff right away, but I feel like they're starting to, you know, come to fruition a little more now. Like, I immediately started playing a lot with Jeff Coffin when I first moved to town, which has been really awesome.
Cool. Yeah.
And he's basically like, if he's not on the road with Dave Matthews Band, he's putting projects together.
Yep.
So as you know, we were strangely, I did a lot of playing and hanging with him during the pandemic because he has a nice big open space to play in at his house. And we would just play trio sessions, all socially distanced with our masks on, mm-hmm. you know, all throughout the pandemic, which was really great, you know, emotionally and mentally and musically. And so some stuff has grown out of that and things along those lines. But he linked me up long before the pandemic with Allison Brown, who's a really great banjo player, mm-hmm. who's based here, and she owns Compass Records. So there has been things. I'm making it sound like I don't know anybody around town. I do have a handful of things going on. It's just, sure. it's just been a little slower than I would have hoped for.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Like, and did you have, you know, as far as why you chose Nashville, you know, for the kind of player you are, I think it's only in the last few years or maybe 10 years that, you know, players like you, with your skill set, with your aesthetic and with your background, start choosing Nashville, because you know, like the sort of cliche existence in Nashville is either you're on tour with a mainstream country act, or you're on lower Broadway, or you're doing like demo sessions or whatever, probably also for like mainstream country acts. But that's really changing. I think it's like, you know, that change is really starting to hit its stride now. So like even 6 years ago, did you look at Nashville and kind of see the potential in that scene for a player like you, who, like, I imagine you have little to no interest in playing on lower Broadway or doing mainstream country tours.
I mean, well, there's two to answer. You kind of have two questions there. The first question being like, did I see the potential? I mean, definitely. And I have been hearing great things. I've been hearing what the whole rest of the world was hearing about Nashville, that it was changing and it was becoming a lot more eclectic, and still, yes, the country capital of Earth, but still lots of new stuff happening and interesting stuff. And my feeling was, you know, yes, I think I bring something, I'm not going to say, you know, special and unique, but a little left of center for this town.
For sure.
To the table, and hopefully people will come to know me for that and call me for as much stuff as possible for me to do that. But at the same time, to kind of answer your other question, I like to work, you know, I'll do anything kind of guy. Like, I want it to be great, and I want it to be, you know, worth my time, and I want it to be a good experience. But I think like my biggest filter for saying yes to a gig or no to a gig is like, how, you know, like who, like, what are the people like who I'll be working with? And if the answer to that is like, oh, they're really good people who take this seriously, and, you know, yeah, maybe it's not the most interesting or innovative music, but like, it's going to be a good experience.
Yeah.
You know, is really where my head goes. And, you know, I don't have the kind of personality that would just assume people on lower Broadway wouldn't be cool, or people on a mainstream country act wouldn't be cool. Like, if people are cool and they are interested in having me play drums, like, I'm considering it. Like, right. That's just like what it is. You know, right. It's not like that's my entire filtration system you know, for deciding to take a gig or not. If it's like, I hear people are sketchy or they're assholes or something like that, and they're super dope, you know, amazing creative people, like it's going to be a hard decision. It's going to be like, I'm going to be hard pressed to say yes.
Right. You know? I'm in a similar headspace. And in addition to the consideration of like, what are these people like, for me, like, you know, the genre doesn't matter. Like the nature of like what the music is doesn't matter as much as like, is it good? Is it a good version of that thing? Is it a high quality version of whatever it is? And if the answer to that is yes, then, you know, the like I said, the specific genre or vibe of the gig of the music, you know, I'm open to whatever. But it's interesting you were talking about in New York, you know, as a younger drummer, and I think we all find ourselves here at one point or another where like you're just busy as shit and killing yourself, and that like that in your mind is some version of success. When
yeah.
Really, if you kind of like take a step back and look at the trajectory of your career, you might just be treading water in terms of whether or not you're advancing, you know, in terms of the quality of the gigs you're playing or the money you're making or the quality of the people you're playing with or just your mental state. Like if you're churning through gigs that don't really matter to you ultimately just to fill the schedule, then you might find yourself burned out and cynical before too long.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail right on the head. And I remember I got to do a little playing with Kenny Werner when I was in New York. And
oh, wow.
He kind of he said something so profound. And at the time, I was kind of like, I mean, I took what he was saying seriously because he's Kenny Werner, but I kind of didn't know what to do with it. But he was just kind of like, you need to have a plan, man. And I was like, I do have a plan. I want to be a busy drummer. Like I'm getting to play some gigs with you. Doesn't that like count for something? I didn't say those words back to him. That's kind of the sentiment I responded with. And he was like, no, it doesn't count for anything. Like, he's like, look at Ari, you know, he showed up to New York. He said, he knew he was going to be doing what he's doing now 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's been working towards that. He's had a plan. And I just never, you know, I never really had a plan because I kind of liked too much different stuff. And, you know, the idea of like leading my own thing and like taking time away from working with other people was, you know, not something that was like super exciting or interesting to me. I just liked the idea of playing R&B on a Tuesday and some jazz on a Wednesday and super interesting singer-songwriter stuff on a Thursday and, you know, continue on. And I'm not saying I regret not taking his advice more seriously. And I feel like things are coming into a little more focus lately for me, which is great. I guess better late than never. But yeah, I totally hear what you're saying. And I think that was part of what, you know, drove me to leave New York, because I felt like I was treading water a bit, and it's not a great place to tread water in. You know, it's pretty deep, yeah. Pretty deep waters over there.
Yeah, for real. And it's amazing how, you know, something that a mentor tells us might take like 5 or 10 years to actually sink in. But it's, you know, it's to their credit, you know, a guy like Kenny Werner, or, you know, when I was in Kansas City, I was in grad school under Bobby Watson, who ran the jazz department there. And
wow,
he, you know, he dropped a lot of knowledge every day. And a lot of it is stuff that I'm sort of just coming around to in the last few years, or seeing, you know, seeing it differently, as an older, hopefully wiser, more mature drummer.
Right.
But like,
right.
It's, you know, it's like Kenny saw that in you, you know, Bobby would see things in me and he would just be like, I'm going to just plant this little seed and it's probably not going to do anything for a while, but maybe he'll get it one day.
Right. Yeah. And I was just telling somebody, another friend of mine, you know, we were talking about like the value of like how to value education, whether it comes in the form of lessons or a degree, or like, how do you put, you know, a dollar amount on those things, and what, how to measure it for yourself as a student, how to measure it yourself as a teacher. And I, you know, it was a friend of mine asking me my advice, because I teach a lot and I also try to learn a lot. I'm also always just tracking down information for the stuff I'm interested in my life. And I said, you know, at this point in my life, in my career, if I spend, you know, a few hundred dollars on something, whether it's a lesson or a program or a course or something, and I get one or two like little valuable bits, like that's worth it.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Like I took two crazy lessons with Bob Moses when I lived in Boston.
Wow.
And it was like cumulatively six of the weirdest hours of my life. But I don't remember a lot of it because it was just like a very strange, like he was kind of all over the place. And he's, you know, like then it's not a surprise to anybody. I don't feel like I'm like talking negatively about him. He's a very unique character.
Yeah.
And, but I got, there was like two or three like kind of like sentences that just kind of fell out at certain points that really, it's not so much that they were the only two or three valuable things that he said. They were the two or three things that imprinted it in my mind that obviously I needed to hear in that moment that was, you know, was just as much on me as it is on him, probably more so on me. And, you know, as strange as those hours were, and I don't remember what he charged me. I don't think it was like, I don't think it was overtly expensive, but whatever it was, I was like, man, that those two or three things made it all worth it.
Yeah.
You know, but you kind of got to, you know, whether it's a private lesson or a, you know, a series of YouTube videos or a course that you're paying for, you kind of got to dig through and find the little gems. And that's what makes it valuable.
Yeah. And I think the further down your path you get, you know, at a certain point, you're not looking for a lesson or a program or anything to like change your life and completely, you know, turn your playing upside down, or like you're looking for it to kind of just keep you on that path. You know, at the end of that path is your goal, in terms of just the overall picture of what you want your career to look like and how you want to think about music. And you're totally right. Like if you can get just like one or two things that just kind of reinforce that, or sort of, you know, do a little course correction to keep you on the path that you want to be on, then those are totally worth it. In terms of like having a plan, like coming out of the pandemic, you know, hopefully we're coming out, I don't know, but you know, do you have kind of a specific plan as far as your Nashville existence? Do you have specific goals?
I do and I don't. I feel like I've got some seeds planted that I'm kind of, you know, hoping will grow in the right direction. And I'm, you know, trying to take care of those as best I can. I'm also, I got remarried recently and I have two stepkids.
Oh, cool.
You know, it's a huge part of my life. And my family and home dynamic has changed a lot, and for, you know, incredibly amazing directions. And I'm very thankful for them. But that's something I'm heavily focused on right now too. So, as far as a plan, like, yes, I do have kind of like goals and things in mind, but I'm not quite, I think also because of the state of the world, I'm not quite ready to like, just go pound the pavement, you know, super hardcore about it quite yet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And is your goal, like, I'm asking this cause I'm in kind of a similar place. Is your goal just kind of abstract? Like there isn't a specific gig that you're after, or like a specific, I don't know, tax bracket or whatever. I'm just thinking, I'm thinking sort of abstractly about how I want my days and weeks to feel in terms of my musical career. And it's not that they're bad now, but you know, there are things I want to de-emphasize and things I want to emphasize more in the future. So are you in a similar place? It's just kind of this abstract, like, less of this kind of thing, more of that kind of thing.
Yeah, I'd say so. I'm thankfully in a place kind of similar to the change in dynamic from the New York treading water life, for a host of reasons. I'm kind of in the first time in my life in a position just to say no on principle to things,
yeah.
You know, which I like was like people would talk about that, you know, when I was younger, and it was just such a weird concept, both because like, how could you say no if you're available, and why would you say no? You know, and now, you know, as you get older, you learn plenty of reasons to answer both of those questions.
Yep.
And, and so I have been, you know, I'm trying to cater my time to stuff I want to be doing and stuff I want to, you know, stuff I want to be doing. I've been playing the drums and playing percussion the way I want to be doing it, as opposed to like swinging in the dark in situations where, you know, like maybe they want this and maybe they want that. It's like, I think I should just, you know, try to put myself in situations where my instincts are doing most of the work. And, you know, if someone needs to say, hey, can you do X instead of Y? It's just a small adjustment to what my instincts were telling me to do in the first place, as opposed to, you know, trying to construct this kind of whole other approach every single time.
Right.
And thankfully that doesn't involve me saying no to a lot of stuff, which means I'm already doing a lot of things that fit that description, which I'm very thankful for.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, trying to be a little more intentional and a little more thoughtful about not so much like what I'm saying yes and no to, but like why I'm saying yes and no to certain things, and like what that way of playing the drums or what way of playing that kind of music, what that makes me feel and what that does for me, you know, musically and, you know, mentally and emotionally.
Yeah.
Letting that be the driving force.
You're preaching to me right now. I love hearing this, cause I'm in a very similar spot, and you know, just as you did, I will, sort of stipulate that I'm in a fortunate position to be able to say no to some stuff. I don't have to say yes to everything. And, you know, I fully recognize that a lot of musicians are just in a financial position where they have to say yes to pretty much everything and go make that money. But if you're able to just be a little more intentional and kind of curate your schedule a little bit more, then there might not be as many gigs, but everything you do will feel like movement in the same direction. Even if those genres are different, those bands are different, like, you know, totally different projects. If, you know, if you're thoughtful about why you're saying yes to stuff, then it'll start to connect from gig to gig, from performance to performance, from project to project. Instead of, like, if you're saying yes to everything, it just feels like you're just kind of doing single punches in all directions with no momentum in any direction, right? You're just working this gig, that gig, get that one done, survive that one, learn that set list. Like, there's no forward continuity to any of it. And I'm so glad I needed somebody to say that to me, because you kind of you crystallize like what I've been thinking about a lot lately. So yeah, good luck with your good luck with
you as well.
Your abstract forward continuity. What were the main takeaways from your time in New York? Like, how long did you spend there?
I was there for 12 years. I moved there the month after I graduated Berkeley right into my mid-30s.
That's a good long stretch.
Yeah. Spent 3 years in Queens in a neighborhood called Astoria, and then 9 years in Bed-Stuy in Brooklyn. And my main takeaways... I mean, I am super thankful for the time I spent there. I think like the people that like to play with me and the people that like me as a person, like, I think they like me because of the time I spent there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I think I'm generally a nice person, but I'm very impatient when it comes to little bullshit. And I feel like the Nashville and Southern way is to give all the time in the world for little bullshits.
Yes.
And I tried it when I first moved to town, and it was so, you know, not authentic for me. And it was so difficult. And I gave up right away. And I was like, I'm just going to be who I am. And that's just like what the deal is. And I'm not saying New York made me that way. I'm from the Northeast, you know, my whole life up until I moved here. Right. So it's not just the 12 years in New York. It's the 35 years till I moved here,
right,
you know?
Right.
And so I think like it, you know, take it, you know, like it or not, it made me who I am. And I think whoever that is, whatever those things are that make me up, is valuable to not only the musicians in my world, in my sphere, but like the humans in my sphere,
mm-hmm.
You know, like my lack of patience for those little bullshits are things that like people turn to me to zap out of our world when it comes time to like some when the need to zap it. They're like, hey, can you zap this really quick? Cause I don't have it in me to do it. I'm like, get the hell out of my way. I'll zap that right out of the way. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm like kind of become that. And I think, that's fine. I'm really painting myself as this total prick. Maybe I am, but,
you said it. It's East Coast versus Southeast. Like that's, or, right. You know, the South in general, it's two very different, you know, approaches just to life in general. But that doesn't mean that, you can't be valuable in the South and valued in the South. It sounds like you kind of, you said you kind of gave up early on, you know, just trying to be something you're not. Did you just kind of come to grips with the fact that you're not going to be everything to everyone and you should lean into who you are? Because certain people will value that and other people who don't value that are, you know, not going to be people that you play with. You're not going to bend yourself to that.
Well, I feel like the last 30 seconds of what you just spoke is like what every therapist in my life has tried to get me to understand. And I've maybe have started to understand it in the last few years, but that's for another discussion.
Right.
Yeah, basically. And I think also it was like I had to trust myself that who I was as a person and as a drummer would be valuable without my needing to re-sculpt or paint something different for that day or for that gig or for that person into my picture, or, you know, whatever analogy you want to make.
Yeah.
It's like however this character exists in space and time, that character being me, and however that character plays the drums, I have to trust that guy, you know, is formed and ready to do whatever it is people will ask him to do. And instead of like having to keep like, you know, the nervous troll on my shoulder going like, well, maybe they don't want you to say that, or maybe they don't want you to play that way. It's like, man, fuck it. Like, I'm just like, whatever I'm going to like say, you know, I'm not saying it's not okay to evolve either. The world is changing very fast in some great and amazing ways.
Sure.
So, you know, stuff, you know, any one of us would have said not even 10 years ago, 2 years ago, you know, it's not cool to say now. And I think I'm in the camp that is in agreement with a lot of those changes. So
yeah.
I'm not saying don't evolve. I'm not saying be stubborn and, you know, don't change who you are to, you know, to keep evolving, but like, you know, change, you know, but like make it a genuine intention, you know, don't just do it because maybe it'll get you some better paying gigs, or maybe it'll get you a more attractive partner or something like that. Just like be who you are.
Yeah.
You know,
we've talked about this before, like kind of in the context of an audition, but you're going wider with it. If you, sort of like tie yourself into knots to be something that you think somebody else wants, you might gain favor with them. You might get that gig, but you're getting it based on an incomplete or not completely truthful version of yourself. And it's not that you have to just like show everything warts and all, like in every interaction. It's not about that. It's just about like, it's so interesting you use the word trust with yourself, because, you know, we've talked about being secure or like knowing your own identity or just kind of knowing yourself. But I think you're maybe the first person I've heard in this context talk about just trusting yourself, trusting your instincts, and just trusting that the person you really are, the drummer you really are, can do whatever the situation calls for without having to, you know, tie yourself in knots, like I said.
Yeah. I mean, on a much more micro example of all of that is like, I have a lot of students come to me and they'll hear me play with Becca Stevens or any number of different folks. And I will often put one of my drumsticks down and pick up a shaker, and then put the other drumstick down and pick up a brush or a weird blastic thing or something else completely, and start making some different sounds. And to me, it really is genuinely me just doing what I would do with sticks holding other things, which sounds very caveman, but it is kind of a caveman philosophy. You know, maybe I've refined some of the technique over the years, but like the seed of the idea is very caveman. And students will come and be like, well, where did you like, you know, learn to do that or something like that? I'll just like take one of their sticks away from them and hand them a shaker. I'm like, play me any groove. just like, do it. You know, like, well, I don't know how to, I was like, you know, like, do you know how to play a shaker? Do you know how to play any groove? Just do it. Like, it's only the two of us sitting here right now. It's okay if it sucks. It's okay if it's cool, if it's amazing. But like, you have to trust that you're, maybe you're not going to knock it out of the park every time, but that it's going to be serviceable and you'll get better at it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think like that, you know, I know like this is a very, very micro example, but like the idea that, again, my instincts will carry me through this, even if my execution isn't perfect. Like the things my ears and my, you know, whatever we want to call it, your heart or your soul or whatever it is, are going to tell my limbs to do will be musically appropriate. Maybe I won't nail it. Maybe it could be done better. You know, maybe Matt Chamberlain would do it better than I would. But it's not going to be this thing where people are going to turn around and look at you like, what the hell are you doing? Like, you know,
right.
Do you even know where one is? Like, it's not going to sound like that. It's going to sound like music, and it'll keep getting better, but you have to trust that it will sound like music on this first try.
Right. Right. So, and that's so interesting talking about execution versus instinct. And in terms of what other musicians value about you, I think, you know, we get very heady about execution. Not just in terms of like, you know, chops or the drumminess of it all, but in terms of tone and time and just all those execution sort of things. And those are important, but you're talking about, you know, a producer or a songwriter or a band leader also valuing your instincts and what you want to do with music and how music moves through your head and how that comes out of you, even if how it comes out of you is not, you know, perfectly executed. The instinct, the intent there is what they value.
Totally. And I think that's, even if, you know, I feel like that, you know, even if it's if we're going to look at this in two very like binary scenarios where it's like, you're either we've called, you know, drummer A because we need the drummer A vibe and we need a thing that guy does, or we've called drummer B because she was the only one available and we need to get a drummer just to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Like either way, even though in our minds A should be going with their instincts and B should be, you know, just trying to hit the target and like make everybody happy. And really, I think the reality is, regardless of the situation, regardless of who you are in the context of the scenario, it's still about your instincts and bringing something good to the situation. And, you know, of course, if it's some very, very specific genre or style or sound, and you are just the furthest person, you know, on earth to execute that, then you're in a little bit of a pickle and you need to figure something out.
Right.
But if we're working within, you know, if you're somewhere within the center of the Venn diagram of like one circle is the styles that I know really well and one circle is the styles I really don't, and you're somewhere in the middle there, just trust your instincts and hope that people will give you the right feedback to help get it into focus.
Yeah. Yeah. This reminds me of a conversation I had a couple weeks ago with Blair Cinta, and we were talking about just, you know, his whole remote recording thing and the idea of just recording in general, recording for a track. And he kind of divided his jobs up into those that require kind of a specific set of drum parts and drum sounds, and those that require a drum performance. Kind of, you know, and that's another way of sort of dividing up, like one of them is execution and the other one is instinct. Is that something that you're conscious of, especially in the studio?
Yes. I love the way that Blair kind of divides it up, because it's way healthier than how I think about it in my head currently. And I'm going to start retraining the way I think about it, because the way I tend to think about it, which is, like I said, not healthy, is like I tend to put some extra pressure on myself to like not personalize parts, but to humanize parts, because my feeling has been they obviously are calling a real drummer to lay down a real drum track because they don't want to use whatever's popular on Splice right now.
Right.
Or they don't want to use Apple loops, or they don't want to use whatever that, you know, they could use. And I appreciate that. And I think the reality is it's not as black and white. And I think I get down on the music world and how awesome sounding not real drums are now.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, but at the end of the day, a human stamp is a human stamp, whether it could be easily copied by a computer or not.
Right.
So kind of going back to the way Blair thinks about it, like whether it's, you know, it's not so much that it needs to, you know, be unrepeatable by AI.
Right.
And it needs to be this like massively human, always changing part. It just needs to sound good and serve the song and serve, you know, and make the producer, the artist, whoever it is, like it needs to fill whatever cup they're looking to have filled for that project.
Right.
And they obviously came to you because they want your instincts, not what's ever in their hard drive already.
Right, right. You and I both come from jazz backgrounds, and I struggle with that same thing you talked about like, you know, putting pressure on myself to come up with something amazing and unique. You know, that's the performance side. Like I put too much pressure on myself to come up with a unique performance for a track when in fact, you know, hewing more towards the execution side and just laying down a set of tones and a set of drum parts, you know, is liberating in a way, right? It kind of frees you up, I don't know. It just seems like a more relaxed way to make music sometimes. Like you don't have to reinvent the wheel. You just got to put down a drum part.
Right. Well, it kind of comes down to, you're kind of like, and I kind of heard Aaron Sterling kind of voice similar approaches where it's like, he's kind of playing producer. It's like, I'm just working for the song. I'm not working for this artist or this producer. I'm working for the song.
Hmm.
And what does the song really need? Which really, that removes everything. That removes the consideration of like, does it need a performance? Does it need great sounds? Does it need something that kind of sounds like the radio? Or does it need something that sounds like radio from 30 years ago? You know, none of that means anything until you strip it all. When you strip it all away and you're just like, what does this song want from me right now? Like, what can I do to make this song the best it's going to be?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And, you know, like, I don't know, maybe it's because I, you know, over the last few years now have children in my life, but it's like sort of similar. It's like, how do I serve this kid? Like, I don't need to like overpower them with like advice and, you know, activities and all the most perfect nutritious food in the world that they don't want to eat. Like they just need the occasional, like, just like use my instincts to make really good decisions to like, if they do need advice or they need nudging in one direction or they need, you know, maybe they do need a chili dog and that's just the way this afternoon is going to go, you know, like, you know, just kind of serving the situation as best you can using, this is the theme of our discussion, but using those instincts and, you know, who you are, as genuinely as possible, whether it's something super pop and there will be no drum fills and it could easily be programmed, but better yet, it'll sound like you not playing fills.
Right.
You know,
right.
Versus some dope drummery track that of course no one would ever program that. It needs to be a human being.
Right. Right. And even, you know, in that super pop track with no fills or whatever, I've found that, you can find a little moment even if it's just like one little thing throughout the course of the song that you know that you heard when you were kind of learning the song or that you just like thought to do in the moment. It could be like one open hi-hat or what, you know, just something that you can kind of hang your hat on and say, I did that. That wasn't a computer. That was me.
Right.
That was my choice. That's my little stamp. Like, you know, even if the producer or the songwriter doesn't like recognize it and say, I love what you did there. Right. Just in your own mind. It's like, I put a little tiny stamp of myself on that little thing instead of like stomping on the whole song with my identity.
Totally. No, I totally hear you. And I tend to find similar small moments like that, usually in the form of, yes, an open hi-hat here and there super does the trick, but also like leaving out one backbeat at the end of a phrase, mm-hmm. like mid-verse or something, you know, is also a nice way to kind of give some air. And, you know, like, not so much that a computer wouldn't have done it, but a producer programming drums probably wouldn't have done it. And I feel like that's a really valuable way to bring your, not just your human element, but your in my case, my 30 years of drumming to that song.
Yeah.
You know, it's just the decision not to play one snare drum in one of the bars for one beat and like can really like kind of like change the shape of at least that whole section, if not the whole song, that a non-drumming producer probably wouldn't have thought of.
Yeah. Especially in the last few years since I've been recording songs in here, I've really started to see the value in taking something out rather than adding something. And like you're talking about it in terms of just that one little moment, that sort of improvisational or spur of the moment choice where, you know, so often we look for a little improvisational spur of the moment thing to be something extra. But the fact that it can be something taken away makes for really cool moments.
Agreed.
I don't listen to the radio. I ain't watching any TV. I don't listen to those CDs or MP3s. I don't watch a lot of movies. I just need to have you live, live all the time. Live in front of me. Ooh, I got to see you live, live all the time. Help the power light a candle now, honey. Oh, I need you live.
Talk about your teaching life, because on your website, you've got this sort of, you refer to it as coaching, not teaching. And you talk about progressions in terms of how you teach and how drummers can sort of move through things. So how long have you been taking this approach and what does that look like exactly?
So I think this is kind of almost always been my approach. It just didn't really come into focus into the last like 10 years or so. But
on April 27th, the Percussive Arts Society Tennessee chapter will present their annual Tennessee Day of Percussion event hosted by Brian Fullen at Trevecca Nazarene University in Nashville, Tennessee, and is open to all drummers and enthusiasts. This incredible event features solo competitions in drum set, concert snare drum, and mallet keyboard. Online registration is now open to everyone who wants to participate. Visit PAS Tennessee Chapter on Facebook or Instagram to scan the QR code to register for this event, the competitions, or to register your percussion ensemble for the showcase. Grand prizes will be awarded to the contest winners, with door prizes raffled throughout the day. Sponsors include Yamaha, Zildjian, Remo, Innovative Percussion, Ludwig, Sabian, and many more. There will be clinics and performances throughout the day featuring Matt Billingsley, currently on the Eras Tour with Taylor Swift, marimba virtuoso and international soloist Andre Vinay, Bob Breithaupt, recognized as one of the nation's leaders in percussion education, and Keith Elio, director of percussion at the Interlochen Center for the Arts and consultant for the Avidus Zildjian Company. Ben Lupton from the Music City Mystique will also present a drumline clinic featuring the Victory Drumline, and Jeremy Chapman will present clinics on Irish drumming. Additionally, there will be collegiate and high school education ensemble showcases throughout the day, featuring the Tennessee All-State Percussion Ensemble. You don't want to miss this incredible opportunity to learn from world-class players and educators. Registration is now open. Tickets will also be available at the door, with registration opening at 8:30 a.m. day of event. Credit card only. Final reminder, visit PAS Tennessee Chapter on Facebook or Instagram to scan the QR code to register.
It's not terribly different than like what all of us think of when we think of the lessons that we took or that we give or that we do take, where, you know, but in my case, I don't really have the capacity schedule wise to meet with somebody every single week at the exact same time. And that's even if we live in the same city, and I have a lot of remote students. So the way it works is I give you something to practice. Well, first, of course, we discuss your goals and the things that you're looking to get out of lessons and what you're trying to accomplish. I craft a lesson for you. I share it with you. And then I include any videos to help explain the exercises or the way I need you to hold your hands or, you know, to hold the sticks for that particular exercise or what we're doing. And then when it's time for, you know, what would be your lesson, you put together a video of you doing those things. You'll share it with me. I go through it, craft your next lesson, so and so on and so forth.
Okay, so this is it's kind of a back and forth between you and a student instead of the two of you meeting at an appointed time and spending an hour.
Right. It's to use a very corporate and Zoom era term, it's lessons async. It's asynchronous lessons, you know.
Oh Lord.
Yeah. And so and I stole that model from a personal trainer that I worked with for a short while years and years ago, someone I followed. I was like on his email list and followed him on social media. We didn't live in the same city, but he had a lot of really interesting approaches to fitness and movement. And so he offered this, you know, kind of remote personal training model like that. And so it didn't really work well for me not to, you know, he wasn't that on top of it. So I was like, well, this was not a great experience, but I'm really inspired by this model. And that's when I started to implement that into and like kind of start advertising for the remote lessons and remote coaching. And the reason I say coach is just because, like, I don't know, like lessons feels a little more like every Tuesday at 3:30, you're going to come to this room and I'm going to sit across from you on my pad and you're going to sit at your pad and we're going to go through these books, which is great. And if I had the capacity to be doing that, I would do that, but I don't right now. So I'd rather take the approach of like, I will coach you through these groups of things you will practice when you're ready for me to do it. And I will curate the things that you will practice, you know, when you are ready to have new things to practice. That was very, very uneloquent. I'm sorry to have put it so
no.
Poorly. That's exactly what it is. I could have chosen like every syllable of that could have been way more hip, but it wasn't.
You want to try a take two? We'll edit it.
Nah, that's okay. Let's just all first takes here. And it works really great. It works, you know, it's not to be too paint too much with a broad brush, but some older students are not so into the idea of it because it's a little too much technology and a little too much like putting together their YouTube video for me. And it's always unlisted. It's not like they have to advertise it to the world, but you know, just like they just rather meet on Skype or on Zoom. And I'm like, we can do that. But like drum lessons on Zoom kind of blow because, you know, it's like the audio is constantly recompressing itself and, you know, it mistakes the metronome for some weird sound it doesn't want to take in. And, you know, it's not built for that. And that's fine. But I've had a lot of other students who like really double down and really focus and just take the information to heart. And like the, you know, growth is marked, you know? So, but I guess, you know, it goes with anything. If you go to try to learn anything, you're going to put the time in, whether it's on Zoom or async or in person, you know, it's like whether you put the time in or not is going to be the differentiating factor.
Right. So like how many, you know, in a given, you know, week or month, how many students do you have on the roster?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it really varies because all the in-person teaching I do in Nashville is mostly, you know, folks that are, it's either like kind of other kind of like working professionals who want to kind of to fine tune something or learn some new skills or broaden some other areas of their playing. Or it's like kind of older, you know, like I have one, like the only student I've had who's been very consistent is really just one kid. And he's about to graduate high school and he's been studying with me all throughout high school.
Mm-hmm.
But even with him, it's been, you know, I like at the end of the lesson, I say, when do you want to come back? And usually people will say like, let me get through this stuff and then I'll call you.
Right.
You know, and that works the best, I think, in general. But I don't, you know, set weekly or even biweekly lessons with people. And so because of that, it's very up and down. So I could easily teach like, you know, 5 in-person lessons in a week and have, you know, 4 or 5 online async check-ins to turn around.
Yeah.
And then I could also have months where I only do 1 or 2 of each.
Right.
You know?
Right.
That's okay.
I really like the idea of you know, both you and the student kind of getting to this when you can. you know, as your schedule dictates. And I'm sure that, you know, you hold yourself accountable to turn things around in pretty quick fashion.
I try to. I don't always nail it. And some students have, you know, they're patient and I appreciate that.
Right.
But, I try to like, you know, treat it like it's a contract and, you know, like they're the ones paying. So the way I view it is like, I owe them something. They don't owe me their check-in. Right. I owe them my feedback.
Right.
You know, so whenever they get to their check-in, my feedback, the clock starts ticking for my feedback. The clock is never ticking for their check-in.
Absolutely. It's like doing a remote recording. Like they have hired you to return a thing to them. So that gets to the top of the heap there.
Exactly.
There are three tiers of this on your website, right? It's kind of, is it a per lesson thing? Like every time you turn something around, like that's your fee, or is it more of a subscription?
It's more of a subscription. It's all subscription.
Oh,
so,
okay.
Whichever level you choose is the amount of check-ins you get per month.
Okay.
So there's a weekly, a bi-weekly, and a monthly.
Cool.
Bi-weekly meaning every other week. Sometimes that means twice a week to certain people, but right, weekly, every other week, and monthly.
But there's bi-weekly or semi-weekly. I think semi is like twice per week, or, you know, semi-annually right. would be twice per year. I get them mixed up.
Me too. That's why I felt the need to clarify.
So when you started sort of doing this, did you like advertise or market this in any way? Like, how did you kind of get this teaching business model on its feet and off the ground?
I haven't marketed it at all other than occasionally mentioning it on Instagram. And honestly, it usually ends up being, you know, it's something that kind of comes and goes for certain people. Like I'll have people subscribe and they'll hang on for, you know, anywhere from like a few months to, you know, maybe a year, and then they'll quit and they'll take some time off and maybe they'll come back. And I don't want it to be the Planet Fitness membership that's so cheap people forget they have it.
Right.
You know, I want it to be the thing that, like, if you're going to do this, let's focus on this. And, you know, like I'm not a cheap teacher, and I'm okay with that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not super interested in like volume of students. I'm interested in serious students.
Yeah.
So I'd rather charge a little more, so it's exactly worth what my time is to me in that context. And it only attracts the people who understand that value. And I totally get that there are people that understand that value that can't afford that price tag. And I'm totally sympathetic to that. And in some cases I've been able to like figure something out with them. But you know, I've had people reach out to me and like, they ask about pricing and they're like, well, why would I do that if I can just go to Drumeo? And I'm like, dude, go to Drumeo. That's like, I'm sure it will serve you exactly as you need it. Like, I'm not saying I'm better than what Drumeo does. It's just a different product and it's a different, coming from a different place. And like, and whatever Drumeo charges to cover their bottom line, I'm charging to cover my bottom line. And it's not meant to be apples to apples. You know, right. it's like some people want apples, some people want oranges. Like that's just the way it is
right.
for me. That's how I think about it.
Yeah. So. And not unlike, you know, remote recording, especially, when it comes to a platform like AirGigs or SoundBetter, you know, you'll see price points just all over the road. Right. Like some people are doing a volume business and others are charging a premium. We interviewed David Blacker, who's like the CEO of AirGigs, and he mentioned that, you know, like you're welcome to charge whatever you want, but a lower fee tends to attract he put it very diplomatically, more diplomatically than I'm about to, but he, you know, a lower fee tends to attract lower quality projects.
Yeah.
And
totally.
You're talking about the exact same thing. Like a low subscription fee for you would probably attract a lot of students who aren't as serious about it as you need them to be for it to be worth your time.
Totally. And one thing I learned a long time ago for myself that I try to preach to my students, very simply, if you can't afford to do a gig, because it doesn't pay well enough, or the details surrounding the gig are so taxing to you that you will literally not be able to afford to do the gig, but you say yes, then it's on you.
Yeah.
Like it's your responsibility to like do the math and like, you know, audit what you know about the situation and say no if you're in the red
right.
by the time you're done doing the audit. And I feel the same way about, you know, whether it's remote recording or it's teaching or something like that. It's like, it's just not good. Like if I can't afford to do it and it ends up not being worth my time, I'm going to perform poorly because I'm going to be annoyed about it.
Yep.
You know, and I've just done that enough times. We all have, where it's just like, I don't want to feel that way. I don't want to output that kind of poor quality into the world, whether it's recordings or teaching or whatever it is. And, yeah, I mean, when it comes to remote recording, my philosophy is you have to really figure out what your range that you're comfortable charging is, you know, for any session. And if your thing is like, I need between 300 and 500 a track, like that's my range. Then for remote recording, and I'm talking about all recording, not just remote recording.
Yeah.
Then I would recommend somebody just charge the 300, because when you're doing it remote, you're probably doing it on your own time. You probably have a little more flexibility. You know, you have a little more control over what's happening. So charge on the lower end, but don't charge a penny below your scale, like your range. Because right. then all of a sudden you're getting into that, like you're activating that part of your, you know, for me, I'm activating that part of my personality that's going to get annoyed.
Yeah.
and that's on me. And that's
totally.
On me. Like if,
totally.
You know,
I forgot who said it recently, but somebody, like in terms of what you're going to charge for a session or a gig, or like, if it's up to you to name your price, you have to come up with a number that is going to make you happy to do the gig.
Totally.
Whatever the gig is, because if you're happy to do the gig, you're going to show up, you're going to do good work, you're going to give a shit. But if it's below that number, then you're, you know, like you just said, I'm not going to bring my best self to that gig.
Right.
And like you said, that's on me. That's my problem. That's not their problem, but I have to like put that governor on myself.
Yeah. It's funny. I was just reminded of a lesson I was taught in high school of all times in my life, which couldn't at all imagine the scenarios where this would be relevant at the time when I was 17. But now that I'm 40, I know it all too well. But this guy that I was working with back then said, you know, he was like, if someone asks you to do something that you really don't want to do, you know, figure out what your normal price would be for it and times it by five. So like that way, if they say yes, you're getting paid five times what you thought you would. And if they say no, you're not that bummed about it because you don't want to do it anyway. and so I was on, which, you know, it feels cartoonish, but then you think about a situation that I was in 2 weeks ago where I was on a gig and we just finished. And it was like the classic situation where the whole crowd was wasted and we just played two super long sets and we were satisfied with our work and we were done. And we finished our last song and the crowd was acting like we had just started and, you know, started, you know, chanting for more. And there was no more. It was not a situation where there would be more. And this guy with a $100 bill in one hand and a wad of cash in his other hand walks up to the saxophone player and he just says, saxophone solo, $100. And the saxophonist is this really sweet kind of, you know, mellow, you know, like non-confrontational dude who's a very close friend of mine. And he'd already started packing his horn up and I could see he was like kind of half considering it. And the other half of him was like, how do I get out of this situation?
Right.
You know, and he was like, I don't know, sir. I don't know if I'm allowed to. He was kind of trying to play the, like, you know, the gig's done and I don't know if we're allowed to have more music now or something like that. And I just quit packing my stuff and I walked over and said, he'll do it for $500. And the guy was like, I just want a saxophone solo. I was like, you don't think he's worth $500? Like, that's how disrespectful could you be? I kind of got that. Here's the East Coaster in me coming out.
Right.
But like, you know, but it was partially me protecting my buddy who, and I make it sound like he didn't need protecting, but I got a little protective in that moment. He didn't need my help, but you know, and it was also partially me being really fucking done with this guy and this gig. And everything up until that moment was fine,
right.
But like this, the disrespect that was like this guy was fire breathing onto the stage, I just couldn't deal with it in that moment. And that ended up derailing the whole thing, which I kind of wanted my buddy to make $500. And I was going to encourage it. He's like, he didn't specify how long. So take the money first and play for as short as you think you should.
Yeah.
But, you know, but it was, but then he's like, how did you come up with 500? I was like, well, he was offering you one. And if there's ever anything you don't really want to do, times it by five. You know, that's just use my old buddy Dwayne's suggestion to me from, you know, 25 years ago.
God, that's great.
And it derailed the whole thing. So, you know, that was like one of the optimal outcomes of the scenario.
Right, right. And that guy fucked up because, in like you said, in one hand he's got $100, and in the other hand he's got the rest of his money.
Oh yeah.
So you saw.
And,
like...
I come from a family of hagglers. Like I used to go to flea markets with my mom, and she would like we'd be walking in, and she'd be taking off her jewelry and like putting it in her purse. You know, because she was planning on haggling over things and didn't want to like show her cards, you know. So I was taught by the best both to like, you know, how to do it and how to like look for the signs. So yeah, he had no idea what he was doing.
Yeah, that's brilliant. I love that. And, you know, whether it's a situation like that or, you know, whether or not you're going to say yes to a gig, you know, going back to our earlier conversation, it feels so good to just say no to stuff that you're not into. Like, if you don't have to do it, if you don't need that money, if you ignore the instinct of like, well, fill the schedule up, go do the gig, you're free. Like, if you just say no to some shit that you know you're not going to be into, man, that feeling is as good as making money.
Yeah,
because like you've made time now, right?
Mm-hmm. Which is the one thing you can't replicate and make it more of. So
yeah, so like maybe I'll fill that time with a gig that I'm gonna love. Maybe I'll smoke a cigar on the porch, but I'm not doing that gig.
Exactly. Back in my New York days, I used to work with this really great tuba player, and he had a salary job as the musical director and choir director for a church, like a very, you know, there's no what do you call them? Now I'm showing my real non-Southernness about me. Like there's no mega churches in New York, but this was some church in the Bronx that had enough cash flow to have a salaried musical director that would, and like pay him health, give him health insurance and things like that.
Right.
So, you know, he had very, very busy Wednesdays, Thursdays, and Sundays, you know, whatever, you know, with like choir rehearsals and actual services and things like that. So we were on our way to a gig together. I was driving, he was in the passenger seat, and he gets a call, and all I hear is his side of the conversation. You know, it wasn't on speakerphone. And all I hear is, hello? Yes, this is he. What's the date? Hang on, let me check. He looks, puts his phone down. He's looking at his iCal, goes back. He's like, how much does it pay? I'm sorry, I'm not available. Goodbye. And hangs up the phone.
Wow.
And I was just like, what just happened? I was like, it was mind blowing. He was like, and he just said very matter of factly, he was like, it was a Saturday night gig, and my Sundays are crucial that I'm on my A game. So it's not that I say no to every Saturday night gig. He's like, but it's got to be great. It's got to be really worth, you know, being really tired all day Sunday and not being super sharp. He's like, and this wasn't that. So I just said no.
Yeah.
And I was free, but you know, it just wasn't worth it.
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa, dude.
Oh man. I am coming out of this interview in that headspace. I love it.
Nice.
I love it.
Nice.
Man, thanks so much for doing this. It was great to finally connect with you for real, because like I said, I've been aware of you for so long. And then you just, you popped up in Nashville at the Underdog with Ty. I was like, shit, there he is. Let's do it.
Well, thanks, man. Well, thanks for having me. I love this podcast. So it's an honor to get to be on it. So I appreciate you having me.
Thanks, man. Really appreciate it. Great having you.
Thanks, dude.
There you go. Hell of a drummer, thoughtful dude, Jordan Pearlson. That was really fun. I hope you dug that. At the top of the show, I mentioned how he's an example of the different kind of drummer that Nashville has been attracting, and next week, Matt Krause will be talking with Nate Felty, who I think definitely fits that category as well. Hope you check that out. Until then, stay safe, stay sane, and thanks for listening. Cheers.